We're doing a bit of a jump in terms of topics tonight. We have been talking about dukkha and sukha, as the Buddha talked about those terms, meaning suffering and happiness, I guess you could translate sukha. So we've been talking about those notions and what they mean to our practice. Tonight I'd like to talk about intention. And I guess the reason that it's come up as a topic is a couple of things. It's arisen to my mind as something that's very important for a couple of reasons. One is, I started to notice the intention as just a subtle thought arising before an action is being taken. And it was just this little gap, or a little very minute gap, that can actually be seen where the intention can arise and the action doesn't occur, or the intention can arise and the action does occur. It's a very strange thing. It's not like there's a me choosing. It's just what's arising. Like, how is it different? So that's one, and I'll talk about that. The other is, I've really been looking at what's arising as my deepest aspiration to do with my time. So I retired, and my partner retired, and now she's back to work. So we were spending all this time together, and now she's mostly working. So now I have this time. So I'm looking at she goes down to the basement and starts working, and you know, I sit in the chair and I've meditated, I've done my yoga, and what's arising for me to do in this moment? And it's not like I want to sit and do like a strategic plan for my, you know, or a goal setting or life, but it's what's arising in this moment. What matters to me in this moment for me to do is how I was approaching it. So the whole idea, the whole notion of intention and aspiration, I guess you could also call it, became important for me this week. The other thing that happened was my teacher, Matthew Flickstein, he retired as a teacher. And I had a conversation with him today, and we talked about how where this came from, and he just talked about how he just noticed a deeper aspiration, something else coming up within silence. Again, not kind of a thinking thing, but just within silence, something deep was coming up for him to do next. So we talked a bit about that. And so that's a big shift that can occur. So I start again. Where does that come? What is that? Where does that come from? Where was this intention and this aspiration coming from? You know, I was looking at the newspaper. You know, the digital. It's not really a newspaper anymore for me. It's a digital. Collection of articles, and really feeling a contraction as I was reading at 17-year-old boy shot at school in Toronto was something that the situation in the Middle East with ISIS and what's going on with that, the situation with Ukraine and Russia, Ebola in parts of Africa, and so on and so forth. And I just started to feel this contraction arise. And I started thinking, well, if humans are inherently gentle and kind, how do we cope in a world that can be so harsh and mean? How do we cope in such a world? Even if we're open. How do we cope with that? And if we're not open, you know, even if we're not reading the newspaper, our friends say, don't engage in that because it'll upset things. And even if you're not doing that, we get in the car, drive to work. How long does it take us? Somebody cuts us off, and the finger goes up, or you know, it's like, whoa, just that moment of you can wake up with this balanced and positive attitude, and then very easily, our life can be disrupted. So, how do we move through this world that can appear to be harsh without ourselves becoming harsh as human beings? Because if we allow ourselves to become harsh and in this, let the world harden us instead of making the world a better place, we can make the world make it worse. Now the answer to this, these questions, I go back to the teachings of the Buddha, and you can go back, you know, what he was saying 2,600 years ago when he was teaching. And some of this, the answer to this lies within this idea of intention. We're called to begin. We were invited and called to begin with intending to be kind, to be open-hearted, and to be gentle in our lives. To setting that intention. The Dalai Lama, he starts his day, every day, with a quote. He says he's got a 4-hour practice in the morning, by the way. He gets up at 4 and he practices till 8. And part of it is sayings that he brings to mind, chanting, meditating, kind of a yoga practice. And at 8 o'clock he says he's ready to go. And he's a busy guy, and he's not a young guy. He's got a long day after he does all this. But this is how he starts his day. I believe this is after he's practiced. This is the thing he does before he moves into the world. It's a Shantideva poem, I guess you could call it. May I be a guard for those who need protection, a guide for those on the path, a boat, a raft, a bridge for those who wish to cross the flood. May I be a lamp in the darkness, a resting place for the weary, a healing medicine for all those who are sick, a vase of plenty, a tree of miracles, and for the boundless multitudes of living beings, may I bring sustenance and awakening, enduring like the earth and sky until all beings are free from sorrow and all are awakened. What a way to start your day. Start with that declaration to go into the world in that way. And if you've ever seen the Dalai Lama move about the day, he does so with that sense of gentleness and openness and so forth. So we begin with those initial thoughts of kindness and gentleness. And if we don't, we're never going to have the experience of them. It's really planting that seed of kindness. Because before we do anything, we have an intention. Now, it can be very quick and very subtle, but before you do anything, there's an intention, whether we're mindful of it or not. So a lot can happen just kind of automatically. We do things on autopilot, unconsciously. But if we bring mindfulness to our moment-to-moment experience and what we're doing and the way we're being, we'll see intentions arising. It's a fascinating thing to do while you're doing walking meditation. The practice that Matthew, my teacher, introduced to me was walking back and forth and not picking a spot where you turn around and not deciding how you're going to turn around before you go, and then just noticing the intention to stop just pops in there. It's not like you said, in 30 seconds, the intention to stop, I'm going to make it arise, just arises. And the next nanosecond, the intention to, no, I'm just going to keep going, arises. And just watching these intentions, some of which you engage in, some of which you don't. But it's just a way of tuning into those very subtle intentions that arise. It's a practice, and a good practice for walking meditation. So we develop this mindfulness towards our intentions. It becomes clear that thoughts precede our intentions. So it's a little blip of a thought and then an intention. And perhaps, and that's why, often I think when you read books on the Eightfold Noble Path, you'll see, right intention is the second one after right view or wise understanding. It's either right view or right understanding. And then it'll say right intention or right thought. Sometimes you see them used interchangeably because that thought and that intention are so intertwined. I think the exact translation is more in line with intention. So bringing mindfulness to this moment-to-moment intention. When some months back, I went on a retreat, or like a field trip, to Crestone, Colorado with Matthew and other teachers. And we met with different, actually more than one, a couple, a teacher in the morning and a teacher in the afternoon. Crestone's like a hotbed of spiritual teachers. There's every traditions, First Nations, Buddhist, Hindu, Christian, but they're all pretty much focused, at least everyone we met, and I think judging by the people around, they're all pretty much focused on contemplative or meditative aspects. So the Christian or monks who spent most of their day in contemplation. We met one Zen teacher, Baker Roshi. Baker Roshi is the heir apparent of Suzuki Roshi, who I've talked about in the past. So he's the teacher that Suzuki Roshi said, continue my teachings. So he's pretty important guy, given the importance of Suzuki Roshi in Western Zen practice. So he was asked to give us a talk. We went around and there's a Dharma talk, much like we're having here, and we all sat around in a circle, and then somebody would give a talk on some topic. I think they were given topics related to teaching. So he sat down and he said, intention, attention. Thank you. And he just sat there, and we just sat there. That was the talk. Very Zen, right? Who expected him to go blah blah blah? intention, attention. But those are the two things, that he just wanted to emphasize. And that, in terms of when we're teaching, really look at intention. What's our intention? What's arising? Be mindful and paying attention to our moment-to-moment experience, like we did in the meditation we did when we started it. It's all about just paying attention without judgment, you know, to what's arising. And setting the intention to do so. You know, as I said, set the intention and bring a gentle effort to just being with what arises. I mean, that's all we can do. It's all we can do. What happens next, who knows? You can set the intention to not have a thought and sit there and all you have is thoughts. But you can set the intention to be with whatever arises. So intention and attention. Of course, we sat for, then we started asking, you know, questions, and it ended up being quite a dialogue. But this intention energizes our presence. And through our presence, we can begin to taste freedom. And taste easefulness in the world, peace, love. And the Buddha pointed this out again and again, that intention is so key. There's so many instances of it. And the fact that it's one of the elements of the Eightfold Noble Path, I think, gives it its prominence. Dr. Martin Luther King said this about with regards to intention: hate multiplies hate, and violence multiplies violence, and toughness multiplies toughness in a descending spiral of destruction. There is only one way out of this destructive cycle of harm causing harm, and that is with the intention to create harmlessness, the intention to be kind. So the importance of intention. Now, one thing as you explore this, you'll notice there's different kinds of intentions that arise. There'll be egoic intentions, and what are sometimes called liberating intentions. So an egoic intention is, you know, something that you want to, you know, be seen, or you want, you know, the ego is trying to project. You're in a group and you're just having a conversation, all of a sudden, oh, I got to say something really smart right now so people in this group think I'm smart. So that's an egoic intention arising. It's kind of feeding the sense of I and me, and separate I and me from you. So those arise. Don't think, oh God, I'm a failure as a mindfulness meditator and the most horrible Buddhist practitioner on the planet because I have these egoic intentions that arise. They arise. What we're doing is noticing, bringing some sense of compassion to it as well. I mean, that's part of the way we're wired, part of the being human. We can't control what thoughts arise. So we can be mindful of what follows. We can't control what thoughts arise. But we can be mindful of the intention that follows. And then the course of action that follows that. So the Buddha always said, it's the intention that's so important. It's not even the action. If your intention was to be kind, but what you did ended up hurting someone, it's considered a pure act, because your intention was pure and harmless and kind. So that's the importance of intention. So we have to develop this intention of wanting wholesome intentions. If you get what I'm saying. You're setting an intention to aspire to wholesome intentions that will lead to wholesome actions and speech. Other elements of the Eightfold Path. Because when we react mindlessly without being aware of intentions, we may act in ways that we later regret. We've all seen that in our day-to-day lives, where when we're kind of in a state of mindlessness rather than mindfulness, we react in ways that we create harm perhaps to others and to ourselves, and regret arises. Wow, I wish I didn't do that. Sets our inner compass. Sets kind of what matters in life. And we need this in order to set our direction. So starting the day the way the Dalai Lama does is a useful, you know, that doesn't have to be the same. Just pick something that just kind of plants the seed for that, for wholesome, kind, harmless, helpful intentions to arise in the day. And of course, you know, you wouldn't be here if you weren't aspiring to those intentions. I mean, you just don't come to Wednesday night meditations and Dharma talk if your intention is to be unwholesome and evil. So I think it's, you know, it's just setting the conditions so that can blossom and can flourish for you throughout the day, throughout the week, and so forth. I think this fly realizes I'm never going to kill it. It's just walking around on there. As long as he doesn't cover up the words I need.
It's pretty cozy.
It's pretty cozy. So, even if you just, let's just pause for a moment and you can close your eyes or leave them open and just reflect. Look at your day. What parts of your day were directed to what matters to you the most? How much of your day was directed at this? To the intentions, the wholesome intentions that you aspire to? Look at what was driving you moment to moment throughout the day. When you felt alive, alive in the body. What intentions were being driven in those moments? Just noticing the intentions that are emerged throughout the day. Noticing what matters to you. And whether you live the day according to what really matters to you. Notice if the egoic intentions arose. Noticing if there was judgment in this moment around that, and realizing that that's okay, just allowing and noticing. Noticing if liberating intentions arose. Noticing if you were perhaps unconscious of intentions. And how the day might look different if you're conscious of intentions. So it's just a way to reflect, and you can do that kind of a practice at the end of your day. So you can kind of set the intention at the beginning of the day through some kind of reading or poem or just a statement, a chant, if you would like. And then at the end of the day, just kind of reviewing, going over the intentions that you were aware of or weren't aware of, and bringing a lot of compassion to that review. If you see an egoic intention, it's not a time to judge and be self-critical. It's to open and to relax into it and just see. There's a Mary Oliver poem called The Summer Day. Who made the world? Who made the swan and the black bear? Who made the grasshopper? This grasshopper, the one who has flung herself out of the grass, the one who is eating sugar out of my hand, who is moving her jaws back and forth instead of up and down, who is gazing around with her enormous and complicated eyes. Now she lifts her pale forearms and thoroughly washes her face. Now she snaps her wings open and floats away. I don't know exactly what a prayer is. I do know how to pay attention, how to fall down into the grass, how to kneel down in the grass, how to be idle and blessed, how to stroll through the fields, which is what I've been doing all day. Tell me, what else should I have done? Doesn't everything die at last and too soon? Tell me, what is it you plan to do with your one wild and precious life? Just read the last few sentences. Tell me what else I should have done. Doesn't everything die at last and too soon? Tell me, what is it you plan to do with your one wild and precious life? So, this wild and precious life, I love that line. It's so true. What's our intention? What matters to us in this wild and precious life? This poem immediately snapped into my head when I started thinking about one of my deepest aspirations. It's like, this Mary Oliver has such a way of just capturing life. There's it's a statement by Anne Frank, who was, I think everybody knows who Anne Frank was, suffered in Nazi concentration camps as a child. In spite of everything, I still believe that people are really good at heart. I simply can't build up my hopes on a foundation consisting of confusion, misery, and death. I see the world gradually being turned into a wilderness. I hear the ever-approaching thunder, which will destroy us too. I can feel the suffering of millions, and yet, if I look up into the heavens, I think that it will all come right, that this cruelty will end, and that peace and tranquility will return again. In the meantime, I must uphold my ideals. Perhaps, the time will come when I shall be able to carry them out. But even amongst that, she's setting intentions to be kind in harmlessness. Now the I'm going to talk a bit about, the Buddha talked about three kinds of right intention. I hope you find this helpful. yet another list from the Buddha, but I find his list helpful. So the three kinds of right intention or wise intention to look for in our day. So the intention of renunciation, and this is an intention which counters the intention of desire. So renunciation comes in when we're mindful of unwholesome intentions, and we let them go instead of acting on them. So if you're mindful, an unwholesome intention can arise. So the intention to, give the finger to the person that just cut you off. Maybe that you see that intention arise. Renunciation is letting that intention go, and not, so it doesn't follow with an action. So you may realize in that moment that your intention to respond with certain words with another person is because you need to inflate your ego and put somebody else down. We can really notice this in our interpersonal relationships with people, noticing that those egoic intentions arising. That's where in my practice, I really notice them. So if you want to bring, pick a time during the day to really practice this, when you're in an interperson, just talking with another person, it's a very helpful time. So can you just let go of that need to put somebody else down and inflate your own ego, and don't act on it, give it up. Because we know that these acting on these intentions causes suffering for others and ourselves. And then the intention of goodwill, noticing when that arises, and then allowing the action to follow. So the intention of renunciation is letting go of those unwholesome intentions when you notice them arising. And this is mindfulness, right? We always say bring it mindful. All the time, even when you're dreaming, if you can, just practice actually bring mindfulness into your dreams. But I won't talk about that right now. So we'll get started with the waking state and just being mindful of what's happening moment to moment. And another word for goodwill is metta, or loving kindness. And we can cultivate this in ourselves. There's metta practices that we can engage in that will help will cultivate loving kindness. A teacher that teaches here, Michelle McDonald, who comes to Galilee through True North Insight. I don't know if any of you have been to her retreats. You're going to her retreat coming up? Excellent. She was a teacher of mine way, way, way back. And she had, she'll probably tell you this, she says it all the time, so I'm not sort of letting anything up. She had a fairly harsh life growing up. So when she came to the practice, she felt she was full of a lot of ill will. And she just did loving kindness meditation. Constantly. She'd go to the Insight Meditation Society retreats, and they'd be doing the Eightfold Noble Path and Four Noble Truths, and people would be acting away about this and the Dharma talks, and she'd just sit there the whole 3 months and just do, may I be well, may I be happy, may I be filled with loving kindness. And she had her mantra that she just went through. She just did that for years. And for years, that's all she did was give. She gave metta retreats, and that's what I went to with her many years ago. Now she's like, I think she's done so much metta that when she speaks, like metta just like flows out of her and encapsulates you. That's the sense I had of her being. So metta is a wonderful practice. The second intention is the intention of harmlessness. which encounters the intention of harmfulness, non-harming, and not harming or doing violence to anything, including the fly that might land on your. Mosquitoes can be a little, they're fighting, but literally, the Buddha said everything, non-harming to everything. This requires a sense of compassion or karuna. And the Buddha also provided practices to cultivate karuna or compassion. It kind of goes beyond just not harming, so not like killing things or, hurting things. But it requires a kind of active willingness to be with the pain of others, to suffer with. And compassion really means, to suffer with, to be open to being with the pain and difficulties of others. So setting that intention kind of takes the notion of non-harming a step further. I did the three. The one intention of renunciation, intention of goodwill or metta, and the intention of harmlessness. So, Thich Nhat Hanh, who's a Vietnamese Zen monk, who was my primary teacher years and years ago, would say that to write your intention on a piece of paper and hang it where you see it frequently. So just write it down on a piece of paper and hang it up. So what's your deepest intentions or your deepest aspiration? And come back to ask yourself, what am I doing in the present moment? What's arising in the present moment? So bringing your awareness to what are the intentions arising now? So it was interesting when Matt talked about, exploring what his deepest aspirations were. He didn't say, I sat down with an Excel spreadsheet and, really started thinking hard about what my plans are and, what I've accomplished in my life. And I don't know, there's all these methods of, goal setting. And I mean, if you get a life coach, some of them will take you through them. Career planning and all that. He didn't talk about any of that. He basically sat in the silence and watched for what emerged into the silence as an intention. And then shared it with his wife. And they talked about it a little bit. He went through that part of the process. But ultimately, it was what emerged for him in the present moment. The other thing Thich Nhat Hanh says is recognize your habit and energies. Look at your habits that are kind of pushing you through the day. What kind of habit patterns? Very useful to look at these. If it's workaholism, we're just working, really distracting ourselves from any sense of peacefulness and from the moment in some cases. We can be going so much so fast, it's almost like we're on a treadmill. And there's no sort of sense of the present moment. I don't know if you've noticed that. And it seems to be speeding up. You see it, waiting in the doctor's office perhaps, and somebody will come in and they'll sit down and there's a moment to be still. It's usually pretty quiet in the doctor's office, and you'll notice it could be just this urge to pull out a phone, even though there's signs everywhere, no cell phones, or pick up a 5-year-old magazine even and read that. The old Good Housekeeping magazine, but just this sense of always having to be doing and just being aware of that, noticing our habit and energies. Notice catching yourself when you're on autopilot. Say, hello, hello autopilot. Hello habit energy. As soon as you do that, it loses its power over you. Say, hello. Thich Nhat Hanh likes those little kinds. Just say hello to your, you know, ill will. And just say, hello, ill will. How are you today? Bye-bye. But he says, say hello to your habit energy. And then his fourth one is to cultivate bodhicitta, which is this sense of this compassion that we were just talking about. I'm going to quote Oprah Winfrey. Actually, I have a lot of respect for Oprah Winfrey. The things she did, I mean, she brought Eckhart Tolle into the mainstream and brought a lot of these practices into the mainstream. So, she does a lot of interesting and I think helpful things in the spiritual world. But this is here's what she said. So she's quotable in my view, I guess. Before you agree to do anything that might add even the smallest amount of stress to your life, ask yourself, what is my truest intention? Does this line up with what I've decided is most important for me? Give yourself time to let a yes resound within you. When it's right, I guarantee you that your whole body will feel it. Now, these are actually very wise words. Your whole body will feel it. And this is really when your deepest intentions arise, you will feel it in your whole body. You feel a tingling, or a, you know, as opposed to a contraction or a heaviness. You'll feel a lightness, a tingling. You'll feel it in your whole body. So it's very wise word. Give yourself time to let a yes resound within you. When it's right, I guarantee that your entire body will feel it. That's your truest intention. See, I don't just quote the Buddha. I quote Oprah. So how do you know if it's a liberating intention or egoic intention is the question I often get. Like, how do I know? Like, you know, the mind can be kind of slippery. You know, and that minds are actually pretty good at convincing you that egoic intentions are the real thing. So how do you know? So first, there's three things you can look at. First, a liberating intention has to do with manifesting what's already inherent in your being, your true nature. It's like a flower blooming. That's the nature of the flower, is to come from a bud and then emerge into a flower. So it's liberating intentions is that sense of your inherent goodness that Anne Frank was talking about to emerge. To be who you are. So it's about manifesting this. So it's not about setting goals, and to-do lists. It's really just sitting with and manifesting who you truly are. So that's the first thing to look for. And that may seem vague to you, but the other two might be give you concrete pointers to what when that actually happens. You'll know it's a liberating intention if it's embodied. As Oprah said, when you feel it in the body, when there's a zing or a tingle in the body, it's sincere. A sincere intention. It's this innocent quality, it's tender, it's alive, caring, but you notice it in the body when it's embodied. So that's the second one. And the third one, it always relates to the moment. What's arising in this moment. So again, it's not this kind of forward thinking. I mean, it may have to do with the future, but it's not like, you know, sitting and planning, setting goals and so on. It's present moment, centered, embodied, and manifesting your true nature. So those are three things you can look for to see if it's a liberating intention or a egoic intention. So just, I think it's important too that to recognize that just by asking the question, is this a liberating intention? You're really opening the door to liberating intentions. You're opening the door to that, to the mystery. And you may not know, but you know, you're allowing, you're being open to that possibility. It'll arise again in the stillness. In fact, if you give yourself enough still moments, your deepest aspirations will just like be knocking, like pounding at the door in those still moments. So I'll just open it up to any questions or comments about the intention. Or anything else that's any questions you might have about anything else, some of the practices we did perhaps, or your practice in general. And we have this little guideline, I guess that we're calling it now. So before we talk, we go put our hands together and we bow, and then everybody recognizes the person. And then when you're finished, you do the same, just so we know when you're finished. And we usually go by it, but sometimes we go back and forth, so there's no like penalties if you break the rule. So I'll just open it up.
I'm intrigued by this thing, Anne Frank's thought of stuff that she sees about the anachronism in people. Mm-hmm. Because in the midst of the Holocaust, some historians are now estimating that as many as 500,000 people were involved in planning, organizing, and had been following and sending it out.
Yeah.
How
is she able to maintain this view of the vision of humanity? Yeah, I don't know how. Nelson Mandela, I mean, there's lots of examples of people who, in the midst of, and I met people, you know, we visited people in the Philippines who were in political prisoners in jail, simply just thrown in jail for no trial, just for speaking out about what was going on. But they had this sense of goodness, inherent goodness. So it doesn't mean, you know, everything, you know, obviously it started with the headlines in the newspaper where the world can be a very harsh place and a lot of cruelty. But it seems that many people that live through this see the inherent gentleness and goodness of humans. Yeah.
I think it's it's a good question, but I think it's a Polish poet, Sergio Milos, who was a young man when the Second World War began and was with the Polish resistance, which, as you can imagine, was an incredibly dangerous thing to do. But he said, you know, he was so surprised when he came to America to see the American perception of the Nazis, how, you know, they were so evil and they were dangerous and all that. He said, not to dispute the evilness, he said that if you actually lived in a place where they were the administration, you saw that they were, the chief characteristic of the Nazis was stupidity. Because the one thing that they were able to do was produce bark. That was it. They couldn't do anything else. So he said, if you lived under the Nazis for even a short period of time, you realize that they weren't going to be around for long. So nobody was worried. He said he had occupied, you know, at least in Eastern Europe, and occupied Eastern Europe, nobody was worried about the Nazis being the occupiers were any length of time. No, not a chance. The question was, what happened after that? So, I think that might be part of the answer, in a way, is that, you know, evil, or not even evil, but just ill intentions, are so harmful to the person who lives that way. You can just see that it just generates misery. I'm astonished by people who are able to forgive, you know, for whom it's not just some sort of intellectual exercise. And I think of Ajahn Viradamo, who's a Theravadan monk, he's the abbot of the monastery at near Perth. And he wrote one, a Cambodian woman, who's two of her brothers and some other family member, maybe her father, were murdered by the Khmer Rouge. And she managed to get out of Cambodia and come to America and, you know, start a life in America. But she was miserable. She was just filled with hatred for these Khmer Rouge people. Just obsessed with hatred. And she hadn't practiced Buddhism for many years. And then she met an old Cambodian monk who you know, she talked to, and he gave her some practices. So she started practice earnestly, you know. And eventually she went back to Cambodia, to where her family, you know, family members had been killed. But she went back to apologize to the Khmer Rouge, she found the actual people who had killed her family members, to apologize to them for having had ill will. And it was absolutely transformative for these men who had done these things when they were young men. And, you know, their lives changed, and you know, it was all remarkable. To me, those are the real heroes. So somebody who can really, sincerely, you know, have that kind of level of compassion. For, first of all, I think starting with herself, that's what she starts with. You know, she's able to give it to even people who murder family members. That's extraordinary.
Towards the beginning, saying something about, and I don't know anything about this like meditation, I know more about just mindfulness meditation, about it as sort of a spiritual aspect to mindfulness meditation. I'm not sure if I understood the comment.
Yeah, it's, well, insight, the phrase insight meditation, I guess, has been coined more by those practicing mindfulness from a spiritual foundation rather than, basically, you'll see the word mindfulness everywhere now in society. It's become quite widespread in quite recent, but these practices have been going on for centuries. What's happened is somebody like Jon Kabat-Zinn came along and took the four foundations of mindfulness, which is the Satipatthana Sutta, and really took the Buddha out of it. Even though the Buddha wrote it, and made it an accessible teaching for anyone, which is fine. I mean, some people have a problem with it because they may say it's the commercialization of Buddhism or whatever. It's actually in all the traditions, not just Buddhism, but these kinds of practices. But really, what John and his heart, his intention was coming from harmlessness and caring, was to make something that he found beautiful and helpful available to just to anybody. So, you know, what he saw and what I see is, as soon as you say, you know, the Buddha or Jesus, or some people, just like a wall goes up, and you've just created this huge obstacle to them engaging in the practice. So would John say, okay, well, I don't know, do you need the Buddha? The Buddha would probably say no. Throw out the Buddha. I mean, he would probably, yeah. He always gave his teaching to people where they were at. And you know, if they were, I think if he figured they didn't want to hear a lot of spiritual stuff, he probably, you know, he would just give it to them straight. If they thought they were very spiritual, he, you know, he'd cloak it in some more spiritual languaging. So, that's the only difference, really. It's the same practices. Now, having said that, I really think that the spiritual aspects of liberative teachings, whether they be from any tradition, they have a resonance and a power that you don't get from, you know, the MBSR and mindfulness meditation. I think, you know, you find people go so far with the mindfulness meditation, and then they start to, I mean, you can't help but open to the mysteriousness of what's of the world when you sit in silence for 45 minutes every morning. So there's a spiritual element is going to emerge, and then there's going to be questions of a spiritual nature. Like, what is this? What's going on here? Who am I? I'm starting to notice that, yeah, I'm not my thoughts, and I'm not, so what the hell am I? Like, what's going on? So you start to ask these kinds of more, these questions that are more spiritual. Of course, the Buddha would never give answers to, like, who am I? He'd just give you a practice to go, you know, to go figure it out yourself. But which has its, its benefits as a way to experience truth rather than just be told what it is. But yeah, I've given a long answer to it. So I answered at a few levels. They're the same, but I think they also, the spiritual aspects take the teachings into areas that you just can't go necessarily without introducing the direct teachings of some of these spiritual of the spiritual teachers.
I appreciated the topic today. Intention is, for me, it's a very important thing to think about, especially sometimes when if I wake up in the morning and I just feel cranky. I don't know why. I just wake up feeling cranky. And if I think my intention is to be kind, well then, I see my husband, like, I'll realize, I want to be kind. I'm just feeling cranky now, so this is a good time to just be quiet because I want to be kind. And I just woke up feeling cranky. It wasn't my fault. And, and the intention is to be kind. Therefore,
I was on a week-long retreat. And Sunday with my teacher Daryl Ross, and it's part two. We're starting part two of a program that Daryl's been offering. First one lasted 2 years, and so right now another 7 year. Maybe we'll do something after that. And it was at Galilee Center. If any of you here are thinking about going on a retreat, Galilee center itself and be able to sway you to go. It's beautiful. Oh, right on the Navajo River in our empire. See the wolf crows, pine forest nearby, beautiful place. But we spend a lot of time doing what you might call the kind of spiritual teachings, or the, well, in Tibetan Buddhism, and Stephen mentioned this in passing, they have this idea of absolute bodhicitta, which is just a way of saying absolute reality, you know, reality as it is. And then relative bodhicitta, which is kind of how we live our lives, what decisions we make, and so on. And the experience of the absolute bodhicitta was through, we worked at through what are called non-dual practices, where, for example, you ask yourself to sit in meditation and quiet your mind down a bit, and then you ask yourself, who is thinking? Okay. What is the thought? And you watch your mind and you see this thought just kind of going nowhere. And if you don't engage with it, you don't, you know, let it kind of breathe, if you just notice that a thought has arisen, you'll also see that it just disappears. It comes out of nothing and goes into nothing. So when you think, who's thinking? Or you might catch yourself having a thought as a dialogue. It's interesting to ask yourself, who is talking to who? But there are two people in my mind? But there must be a third, because somebody's watching this conversation or hearing this conversation. So those kinds of, I find that especially in longer retreats, if you're able to go to a longer retreat, that although there's that kind of, that kind of focused attention is hard, very difficult to sustain outside of the lovely conditions of the retreat where the food is prepared for you, and really all you have to do is get up in the morning, go to bed at night. It's really in the middle, you know. Just to have some experience in that, I think is so helpful because, you know, hopefully you're able to remind yourself that you've got this big mind stream going, this big story going about something, and you say, oh yeah, like, thoughts come from nothing and go back to nothing. There's nobody, I'm not this guy having this conversation, who is he? Who's he talking to? And it's all very, it's astonishing when you take it for granted. You think of how very strange it is that we have conversations in our heads. Like, how is that? How come we think that's normal?
And the thought precedes the intention. So being aware of, although, you know, from the absolute ultimate truth, there is no one having a thought. And there's no intent, no one having an intention. But at the relative level of where we live our lives, the thought is important. So it's not real, but it's important, if that makes sense. So we have to be a good custodian, if that's the word I'm looking for, of those thoughts, which aren't real. So it's a paradox, but it's very important to this practice, especially, you know, if we're newer to the practice, to really to be aware of how thoughts arise, form into intentions, and then result in a course of action, which has results, that has reverberations, karma. In society and to ourselves. Yeah. Well, thank you everyone for coming. It's great to see you all and to meet the new people.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.